Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Lewis Katz.
And I'm Jillian Ma.
This week on War News Radio, coming out, we follow up on the status of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Then we speak with an Iraqi refugee adjusting to life in the U.S.
Finally, we hear from a war journalist who has spent time in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Afghanistan's election commission has disqualified about 1 million votes from the September parliamentary elections due to suspected fraud. Commission spokesman Noor Mohammed Noor said the committee targeted clearly tainted ballots, such as those from centers where 95% of votes were in favor of one candidate. The commission must still investigate over 2,000 other serious complaints before it can announce the results of the parliamentary election. Last year's presidential election was marred by violence and vote rigging.
Coalition efforts to rid southern Afghanistan's Kandahar province of the Taliban have recently made progress. Kandahar is an important agriculture and opium production center and is key to NATO's counterinsurgency program. Milajat, a village on the edge of Kandahar city and a former Taliban stronghold, is now completely clear of insurgents. However, mines still litter the town and its fields, preventing former residents from returning.
A report published this week alleges that the U.S. was abusing prisoners in a secret jail in Afghanistan this year. The report, published by the U.S. policy think tank Open Society Foundations, interviewed 18 ex-detainees who said that they were deprived of sleep, not given enough food or blankets, and prohibited from practicing their religion. The U.S. military has repeatedly denied any existence of a secret jail, claiming that all its detention centers abide by U.S. and international laws.
Afghan health officials have reported a serious outbreak of a tropical parasitic disease transmitted by sandflies. According to the World Health Organization, the disease endangers the health of 13 million Afghans. The disease is not life-threatening, but leads to painful skin sores and severe disfiguring scars. Although it's treatable, many Afghans cannot afford the expensive medication. The acting Afghanistan Public Minister of Health, Saraya Dalil, has appealed for international help in combating the disease.
An American soldier has been detained on suspicion of shooting an Afghan prisoner. The prisoner, a suspected Taliban insurgent awaiting transfer to another detention center, was found dead in his cell in Kandahar province.
The Justice Department announced it will no longer pursue murder charges against Andrew J. Moonen, a former Blackwater employee accused of killing an Iraqi security guard in 2006. Despite more than 3 years of investigation, Justice Department officials decided there was a lack of evidence to indict Moonen. He is now one of many former Blackwater employees the government has failed to successfully prosecute.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki spent this past week visiting several neighboring countries, including Syria, Jordan, Iran, Egypt, and Turkey. Al-Maliki has been traveling in hopes of winning regional backing for his bid to secure a second term in office. While in Iran, al-Maliki met with Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. It's believed that external pressure from Iran enabled al-Maliki to obtain support for Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of Iraq's Shiite faction, last week.
A roadside bomb killed an Iraqi official and wounded 8 others in Baghdad this week. The official, Jassim Muhammad, was a member of Baghdad's provincial council and a leader in the council's services committee. The bombing comes as a continuation of other recent attacks that have primarily targeted government and police officials.
This is War News Radio. Because the Senate did not pass a bill repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell before its break for the midterm elections, it looked like hopes for repealing the policy were gone. But court action has revived some of those hopes. Sam Hirschman and Min Chuen Nguyen followed up on some new developments and the strange situation they produced. Here's Sam.
U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Phillips ruled the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy unconstitutional in September. About a month later, she issued a worldwide injunction on the policy. According to Diane Mazur, a law professor at the University of Florida, an expert on the Constitution and the military,
what it means is that she's issued an order barring the military from enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell in any place that the military operates at any time in any way. It is as broad as an order can be on this subject.
Suddenly, it was okay to be gay in the U.S. military, at least in the eyes of the law. A flurry of legal activity followed the injunction. Motions, replies, appeals, stays, and orders. For now, it looks like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the 1993 policy banning gays and lesbians from serving openly in the military, will stay in place. The injunction was in effect all of 8 days. During that time, the Department of Defense allowed gay people to enlist in the military. Service members could come out during the injunction and continue serving, but the DoD warned that such statements may have adverse consequences. David Hall of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, an organization devoted to giving legal aid to gay service men and women, said the organization's advice was to keep quiet.
We would tell service members that are currently in, you know, don't come out. And then we would tell potential recruits that are going to the recruiter's office to, you know, be cautious.
Some gay soldiers are taking that advice. Unfortunately, perceptions about the law have made caution difficult. Ty Walrod, a co-director for OutServe, a worldwide underground network of gay and lesbian service members, says some people are being outed by their comrades who think the policy is over.
We are aware of a lot more service members who are coming out, either being innocently outed by friends of theirs in a friendly manner where there is no hostile intention, but where the service members may not have wanted to particularly come out. Our concern is if any of these people are outed in this potentially interim period, we want them to be protected and not lose their careers because they were outed.
However, the number of service members coming out has been small. Most are keeping a low profile and focusing on the mission, according to one Coast Guardsman. The helicopter pilot, who has 10 years' experience, declines to be identified because he is gay.
And while those things are going on outside the military for us, our focus is on our job and on our daily duties. And, you know, we understand that, you know, there are things going on, you know, not sort of behind the scenes, but maybe above our pay grade, as we say in the service. For us, it's business as usual. You know, we still show up every day. We show up at our duty stations. You know, we answer phones. We send emails. We get into helicopters. We get into tanks. But until, you know, we hear it from our service chiefs, you know, until we get the official word from, our military leadership, for us, it's just, you know, stay the course right now.
But the people higher on the pay scale don't really have an answer. Though it opposes the policy, the Obama administration believes that repealing it overnight could cause problems for the military. The administration wants action to wait until the DoD has finished a study on how to repeal the policy, and for the repeal to come through Congress. But Mazur suggests that may not be all that is going on.
He has made a political agreement with Congress to the effect that I, the president, will not weigh in with any authority or discretion that I have. I place the situation entirely in your hands, that you may act to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell Congress when you are ready to do so.
Mazur thinks President Obama, by abdicating his authority, has created part of the problem.
When President Obama steps back and says, I don't want to have anything to do with this, what it does is it introduces paralysis into the system.
But some activists and service members would like to see Don't Ask, Don't Tell back in Congress, according to Walrod.
A lot of people, at least in our network, are still looking to the Senate to permanently remove the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law from the book. Obviously, people are happy about the ruling. We know that a stay could be granted by the Court of Appeal or by the Supreme Court if they deny it. So we know there's still risk that Don't Ask, Don't Tell could come back into play. In my personal opinion, the best way would be for the Senate to repeal the law, as the majority of Americans want and the Obama administration has promised.
Sue Fulton, the communications director with Nights Out, an organization of gay and lesbian West Point graduates and their supporters, notes that congressional action would return control of this issue to the military.
Congress should approve the law as it is stated in the Defense Authorization Bill, because all of that law does is repeal the law, but it does not repeal the policy. What I mean by that is the vote has wrongly been viewed as an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when really what it does is it puts policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell back in the hands of the military where it was until 1993. That way, the Secretary of Defense, the Department of Defense, can look at all of the data that the working group has been researching and make the right decision. And I believe they will.
Our Coast Guard source says that will allow the military to move on to a more important question.
How do we make this, you know, a better military with gays and lesbian women?
However, answering that question may be a long way off. Recently, the DOD made it more difficult to fire people under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. All discharges would be decided by the secretary of each branch of the military and the military's general counsel. But a permanent solution has to come from Congress or the courts. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has put a temporary stay on Judge Phillips' injunction while it decides whether to enjoin the law or not. There is a possibility that the stay will be lifted and the military will be thrown right back into uncertainty. While the issue is moving through the courts and could ultimately reach the Supreme Court, Congress might also take action. Though a bill that would have repealed the law recently failed in the Senate, activists believe they will have another shot in a lame duck session after the elections. Until someone makes a decision, gay service members will have to wait and see. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. In 2009, nearly 19,000 Iraqi refugees came to the United States, but the bad economy has made it more difficult for newcomers to find jobs and settle in. In this piece, Abdullah Miziad spoke to one Iraqi refugee who had a difficult year in his new home. But he's still optimistic about his future. This piece first aired in April.
Musa al-Nasiri is an Iraqi refugee living in the city of Vienna, Virginia. He came to the U.S. in July of last year. In Iraq, he always dreamed about traveling abroad and living in the West.
This is the dream of my life. I used to dream to go outside of my country, especially to the West, to live their life, because actually I like to be one of them or to live their life.
I asked him about his feelings when he heard that he was coming to the U.S.
Actually, no one can describe this feeling, because it was a wonderful time, and it was a wonderful event that happened to me, especially when I received a phone call. I was just taking my lunch. My mother just prepared my lunch, and I heard my cell phone rang, and I picked up the phone and say, "Hello, who's speaking?" She said, "I'm from the immigration. Is that Musa?" I told her, "Yes." She said, "Your flight to the United States will be 26th of July."
He was so surprised by the news that he wanted to be sure this was no joke.
I told her, "Can you say it again? Because I'm shocked. I didn't. I'm not so sure about what you said. Or I need you to repeat what you said."
Musa lived a very difficult life in Iraq. He was almost killed in 2007 when a car bomb destroyed parts of Al-Mutanabi Street, Baghdad's main book market. He was working then with NPR as a journalist, and he later worked for agency France Press. He says life in Iraq was becoming increasingly unbearable, and he wanted out.
I just want to spend my, you know, I don't know how many years remain in my age, in my life, but I was thinking to live in a peace of mind and enjoy the quiet life in West countries, and to make this dream come true, and it came true, actually. And I'm still thanking my God about this grace that He gave me after a long wait. And I'm still impressed to be here. I'm still happy that I am here. But you know, there is no perfect in life.
Musa is now 46. His family is still in Iraq, and he is single. He says it's been hard going it alone.
I'm alone. I'm a single. I don't have a family. Sometimes somebody with his family be more comfortable, someone to share his ideas, to share his dreams, to talk to a person. So because I am alone, I'm a single person. Sometimes it's hard for me. It's difficult for me. And I'm looking forward to have someone to share my life with, and to live like others, with a family, establish a family, having some kids, and having a small job opportunity to cover my expenses.
Since he arrived in the U.S., he's been aggressively searching for employment. But so far, he hasn't had any luck.
People used to say that the opportunities are less, not like before, because many people I applied to and many people who talked to me about that, they told me it's wrong time for you to come here because it's not like before. If you came a little bit earlier, it could be good opportunities for you to find a job. But actually, I still believe, everybody got his own luck.
Musa holds a BA and an MA in philosophy and history from Baghdad University. He also finished his PhD studies in history and completed his dissertation, but he never got to defend it.
And defended history dissertation because I supposed to defend my PhD dissertation at least as a maximum 15th of August 2009, but fortunately and unfortunately, I received a phone call to travel to the United States. And unfortunately, it makes me cancel defending or at least postponing my defending of dissertation. So I chose to travel to the United States, then defending my PhD dissertation.
He was so eager to leave Iraq that he gave up on his PhD. But now he hopes to find a university in the U.S. that can review his dissertation and approve it, because he feels he's done so much to earn his degree.
To find somebody to help me how to complete my dissertation, and let me in order to find somebody not to let my time of study and writing to go vain, because actually I did it in a very serious and tough situation.
He hasn't been alone here, though. One of his colleagues at AFP invited him to live at his house when Musa was struggling to pay rent.
I met this person in Baghdad, and he's a very good friend. And when I came here, he offered me to live with him. And the guy is a very good friend. And I talked to him about paying some amount for the rent. He refused because he said, "You don't have a job. So you don't have to pay anything till you get a job." And he's a great person. And actually, he's more than a brother, because what he done to me, I can't describe it.
Musa says times are hard, but he can take it because he's an Iraqi. He's always optimistic about life, and his favorite song is Bob Marley's Three Little Birds.
Because we were in Iraq, we lived a very difficult and bitter life. So we have, I think, some immunity for that kind of difficulties. And everything will gonna be all right.
But at times, the memories of his loved ones overwhelm him and leave him more lonely.
Actually, I miss my mother. And some kids, they used to see me. They used to run to the gate of the door to have a hug from me, or to receive candies. Those kids, I sometimes shed some tears when I remember them.
Musa is now working as a volunteer at Lutheran Services. He helps refugees get settled, although settling in has been hard for him. For War News Radio, I'm Abdullah Maziad.
This is War News Radio. Most American troops stationed in Afghanistan are in the south and east because those regions are more central to the Taliban presence in the country. Many villages in the north have been all but ignored by the Afghan government, the U.S. military, and international aid groups for a variety of reasons. War News Radio's Kareem Saryahmed spoke to Anna Bodkin, who recently traveled through northern Afghanistan to write dispatches for foreignpolicy.com. This piece first aired in June.
Anna Bodkin is a freelance journalist who has recently returned from a trip around northern Afghanistan. The north is generally considered much safer than southern Afghanistan, where the Taliban is most active. The perception that northern Afghanistan is more stable seems to be part of the reason that in many villages, nothing has changed in the 9 years since Ms. Bodkin last visited them in 2001. Wima'ut, 30 miles east of Mazar-i-Sharif in Balkh province, is one such village. A spring flood there covered the whole village with a 6-inch layer of mud, destroying homes and soiling everything but a white pigeon.
What happened was the fresh air flooded the yards. Some houses, you could see the marks, high water marks, and, you know, in some houses it was up to my knees, and other houses it was up to my waist. And there is not a whole lot of hope for these houses. Some houses are simply gone. They just were washed away by the powerful current. From what I understand, these villagers receive no help from anybody at all. The villagers are left to their own devices to deal with catastrophes. And the Afghan government responded by handing out a couple of loaves of bread per family. That was a disaster response.
Minor catastrophes like this one are not unusual in Afghanistan. Most go unnoticed by the Afghan government as well as the media. And the danger of providing aid to the affected villages has greatly increased since the Taliban started targeting international relief workers, which was not always the case.
I was told by one aid worker who works for a relief agency that has been working in Afghanistan for 50 years that it was much easier to work in Afghanistan before September the 11th when the Taliban was in power, because there was an understanding that this relief agency provides relief, and the Taliban let it be and allowed it to, you know, distribute humanitarian aid or, you know, provide health care to Afghans.
The Taliban has been outlawed since then, of course. And with the U.S. occupation, the Taliban is no longer willing to let any Westerners or aid workers simply go about their business. Uncertainty over where they are active further complicates relief efforts.
The government may control a city by day, and by night the Taliban comes in and runs the city. So it's you can never be sure, you know, or very rarely be sure 100% that the area is completely Taliban-free. So it's dangerous. Relief workers who work in Afghanistan today are doing an incredibly courageous and very dangerous work.
But for Afghans who have lived in the same destitution for the past 9 years and have seen almost no change take place since the U.S. invasion in 2001, there is no longer any hope that help is on its way.
They don't understand why is it that such a powerful military machine as the U.S. and NATO has not been able in 9 years to defeat the Taliban, which essentially is a bunch of, you know, guys in flip-flops running around with Kalashnikov rifles. So this, you know, brings forth a bunch of strange and bizarre conspiracy theories. For example, one that's very popular in Afghanistan today is that the Americans and the British are airlifting the Taliban from southern provinces, the hot, you know, the Taliban hotbeds like Kandahar and Helmand, and dropping them in the north. And when I asked, you know, why do you believe this? I was told, well, how else would you explain that 9 years have gone by and areas where the Taliban wasn't 9 years ago now are controlled by the Taliban?
An absurd theory, sure, but it speaks volumes about the Afghan perception of the U.S.
They don't see any results, and that is particularly worrisome because, you know, they very often see Americans as not the source of NATO troops, rather, not as a source of hope right now, but as a source of disturbance. For example, I've spoken to people who worry not that the Taliban will come to their village and impose, you know, strict Sharia law, which already dominates Afghanistan, but that if the Taliban moves into their village, Americans will come and they will bomb their village and people will die then. So Americans are viewed as a potential threat.
This raises the question, who do Afghan civilians trust?
Themselves. These people have learned over millennia to rely on themselves. And there has never been a history of an Afghan government that truly cares for its people. So we're talking about a people that is, you know, already disillusioned in advance in any government and doesn't believe that any government foreign or domestic, can bring it any good. And so people, literally, the idea of your own home as your own castle, as your own fortress, you know, they take it literally. I actually have seen houses that look like fortresses with places to stand and scan the surrounding area through the muzzle of your gun.
This self-reliance is absolute. Afghan families in rural villages subsist on what they themselves can grow or find, and it is a given that their children will work to help sustain their families. Ms. Bodkin met two girls, ages 11 and 12, who were carpet weavers.
These girls were carpet weavers. They earned their family's living by weaving carpets. It's a very hard work. You basically sit on top of a loom that takes up the entire room, and you tie knots forever. From 8 in the morning until 5 o'clock at night, all you do with your life is you tie one thread over another thread incessantly. It takes 7 months or 6 months for four girls to make a hand-woven carpet. So these girls are part, you know, they're part of the workforce. That's what they do. They, you know, and that's what they will do. They will probably be married and probably have children. And if they have daughters, they will teach their daughters to weave carpets when they're 10 or 11 years old. And, you know, and you can't say, well, you know, let's not let Afghan children work because we feel sorry for them, because then Afghan children will simply die. You know, their brothers and sisters will die. Their younger siblings will die. You know, it has to be a solution for the whole broken down system of Afghanistan.
The Afghan government is run largely by warlords who would pose a threat to the government if they didn't hold office. Ms. Bodkin says that a more responsible government is needed to solve Afghanistan's biggest problems. She calls the government a kleptocracy, because ministers in Kabul are getting rich while very little international funding is getting to the provinces.
I think that a way to reform the government, you basically have to say having warlords in the government is not important, not as important as having a functional government that will address the needs of its people. And that is a huge leap that Hamid Karzai's government is not willing to take. You know, first and foremost, because Hamid Karzai is an incredibly corrupt president, you know, who has a home base and wants to control it.
According to UNICEF, less than half of all males between the ages of 15 and 24 are literate, and less than a fifth of females. Less than a third of all Afghans have sustainable access to sanitary drinking water. And one out of every four Afghan children under age 5 will die before age 5. The government does claim to have implemented humanitarian projects in rural areas, but they are barely noticeable given all the people who have been ignored for years. For War News Radio, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
On our site, you can also comment on this show or on our past programs.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anjali Kadambi, Kyle Crawford, Rosanna Kim, Jonathan Kwan, Amandine Lee, Violet Chuvnikas, and Jeremy Rappaport-Stein. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Jillian Ma.
And I'm Lewis Katz. Until next time, thanks for listening.